You have the power to keep this radio station going. You have the power to keep Labrish going. Yeah. So call up, pledge some support. I saw Bob Fosse do a wonderful thing the other night, you know. He said, you know, just as a vote of support, just ring them lines, you know what I mean? We won't even pick them up, just ring them lines. But tonight, with only like 2 minutes to go, Hapte, we saying, if you're calling, call right now.
Yeah.
Make a pledge of support. Get up off of that fence, please.
212-209-2950. And it is a matter that, you know, we have to do it like this, so you know, because that's the way things are. But a reminder that coming up at 5 o'clock, it will be Democracy Now.
Hapte, just to interrupt you, can this be a treat to the people? Family, please forever.
Along the way, in this great future, which is life, you can't forget your past. So dry your tears, I say.
And no woman, no cry. Yes, 212-209-2950. And that is basically where we have to leave it. Again, $75 pledge will get you a copy of this really good DVD. It's Rebel Music, the Bob Marley story, for $75. And a reminder that this evening at 6:30, Medgar Evers College at 1650 Bedford Avenue, the annual tribute to our ancestors of the Middle Passage fundraiser. This evening it is happening at Medgar Evers College. Please do come out, support that. We will be there. And again, our condolences to David Nolan's family. And again, we are dedicating this morning's program to Bentley King. And we are saying to Cedric Brooks, get well, get well. And oh, $25 will help. And we have to say this way that we's got to go. But you've been listening to Labrish. My name is Hapte Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Seduza Kaim Billy and is a De Jazz Mac production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. Mr. Tosh.
We'll build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love on one foundation.
There will never be, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside theme organization. I've got to put aside. Cause we are birds of a feather.
at all. There will never, never, never be no love at all. Got to build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are asking you to go to the phone right now. If you appreciate the broadcast you just heard, the number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Give us a call. Let us know that you're there. Let us know that you're standing up for independent media. We can't do this without you, only with you. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Your call counts. We need you. We urge you to let us know that Democracy Now! Matters in your life. Give us a call. Let us know that you are there. Call now. Let us know that you're there. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You know, while we have you here on this snowy day, just here on WBAI, that we're going to video record this for Democracy Now!
Right.
For the future, I wanted to ask you a few more questions. I mean, it takes a lot to come in today, so I want to take advantage of this time.
Thank heavens for the subway system.
I wanted to ask you about the Goldstone Report.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Khalidi, also Michael Ratner, I'm very interested to know what you think of the onslaught against Judge Goldstone, who mm-hmm. led this report on what is happening in the occupied territories.
I think the most important thing in the Goldstone Report is not just the instances of violations of the rules of war that the report cited about Israeli operations as well as actions of Hamas. I think the most important thing in it is the qualification of the siege of Gaza as a violation of international humanitarian law. And I think that really should be the front and center. 1,400 people were killed, most of them innocent civilians, in Gaza. And though there were, I'm sure, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure there's a great possibility of there having been war crimes there. But the siege of Gaza, the fact that a million and a half people are held hostage by Israel, and this is something that I admire greatly Judge Goldstone and his colleagues for underlining this, is, I think, one of the reasons that the Israelis are so angry. They've, in effect, admitted culpability on some of the specific things that the report talked about. They disciplined two generals. I mean, in other countries, that would be the equivalent of putting people before a firing squad. Two generals being disciplined in Israel, that's much less than should happen, but that's something important. They've paid the United Nations $10 million in compensation for United Nations facilities destroyed by phosphorus and other shelling. I don't think any of this is enough. But in effect, if you look carefully, the Israelis know that on many of the specific accusations in the Goldstone Report, they are guilty. But the most important of them, in my view anyway, is this siege. And to his credit, Judge Goldstone and his colleagues underlined this in the report.
And how do you account for the attack, the onslaught, Michael Ratner?
Well, I think it's really what Rashid is saying, is that the report is of such a high level of accuracy and accurately describing the situation that Israel is sitting there. What can it do? It's been labeled essentially a pariah within international law, and therefore you have to attack the messenger. And what's remarkable to me about the attack on Judge Goldstone is that this, if you had asked me before this report, who are the most respected jurists in the world, name the top three, I would have started with Judge Goldstone, head of the tribunal in Rwanda, head of the tribunal in Bosnia, exceptional, you know, key person in settling the apartheid, ending apartheid in South Africa. And I would have said he's the number one jurist probably in the world. And I probably couldn't name the next two. And here you see what I have to only deem are McCarthyite attacks on Judge Goldstone, because they can't really take on the substance of his report. They can't take on the fact that as we sit here, there is a siege going on that's imprisoning a million and a half people in the world's biggest jail. They have to attack the messenger. And so it becomes the character of Judge Goldstone, who is probably one of the most honorable, maybe the most honorable jurist in the world right now, and yet they feel, the Israeli government feels they can do it, American reporters and others feel they can do it. They really go after him rather than the substance, and it's really an outrage. And McCarthyite is the only way you can describe it.
I remember Judge Goldstone's daughter, I think, going on Israeli Army radio and
right.
being just completely shocked and saying, "My father, Judge Goldstone, is a Zionist."
Right. Saying you're lucky you got my father to write this report and not somebody else. And, you know, when I read the report, my reaction was really strong. I mean, I followed the Gaza bombing a year ago and was very opposed to it. But when you read this, it's there, page by page, of what Judge Goldstone found and the committee found, as well as describing the siege in a very dramatic way. You can't read that report and just not be utterly shocked by the actions of Israel in Gaza right now.
Did you want to add something on that point?
No. And I have to applaud, again, Judge Goldstone for doing this. And the kinds of attacks that he's subject to, I think people should look carefully at that. It's all ad hominem. Very little relation to the substance of what he had to say.
And what about the U.S. administration? What about the Obama administration and its dealing with the Goldstone report?
Well, we have a president who's a lawyer. And we have a president who should know better than to listen to this kind of scurrilous calumny about a respected jurist. We have people who, in our government, who really should be taking very, very seriously what the Goldstone report said, instead of trying to push, as they did, at the United Nations Human Rights Council for postponement of discussion of this report. This should be looked into very seriously, not just because of the accusations against Israel, but because of the accusations against Hamas. If we really want to turn away from violence, if we really want to move towards a better way of dealing with this conflict, one of the things that has to be done is that international humanitarian law has to be brought into it. And that's what the administration should be doing, instead of acting as an amen chorus for Israel on this.
I wanted to ask you about another issue, what's happening in another Palestinian neighborhood of Jerusalem, not in the near the cemetery that we were talking about, but in Sheikh Jarrah. This is a Palestinian resident, Amal Qasem.
Settlers are occupying the houses. They don't have document. Their documents are fake, and they don't have the right to enter in these houses. We are living here since 1956, about 28 families, and we are about 500 people, 550 people, and about 55 families.
What is going on here in Sheikh Jarrah?
What is happening there is that the Israeli police and border guards are evicting families that have lived there, refugee families, driven out of their homes and property in West Jerusalem, and who have lived in properties in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem for, in some cases, 50 years, since 1948 in some cases, claiming that this property is Jewish-owned. So here we have two standards. Property that's Jewish-owned or supposedly Jewish-owned. In some cases, these claims are spurious. As to ownership. But property that is allegedly or supposedly Jewish-owned merits immediate evictions of people who were placed there by the Jordanian government back in the days when Jordan occupied Jerusalem. Whereas people who have property in West Jerusalem can walk by their houses and their homes and their property and see Israelis living in them and have no right to claim or get the Israeli police to boot out these interlopers. So it's typical of the two standards that operate in Jerusalem, the supposedly united capital of Israel, where in East Jerusalem there's basically no justice for Palestinians, and in West Jerusalem, again, there's no justice for Palestinian owners of property whose homes and lands were confiscated.
Finally, this controversy over the New York Times reporter. Reading from the public editor of the New York Times, Clark Hoyt, he says, "The Times sent a reporter overseas to provide disinterested coverage of one of the world's most intense and potentially explosive conflicts, and now his son has taken up arms for one side." They're talking about Ethan Bronner, the reporter.
Right.
Even the most sympathetic reader could reasonably wonder how that would affect the father, especially if shooting broke out. Clark Hoyt goes on to say, again, the public editor of the New York Times, "I have enormous respect for Bronner and his work, and he's done nothing wrong, but this is not about punishment. It's simply a difficult reality. I would find a plum assignment for him somewhere else, at least for the duration of his son's service in the IDF." Your response?
Well, you know, the Times polices its own in its own way. I have nothing to say about that. If they think he's violated their rules, so be it. I don't think they looked at his coverage very carefully. This is someone who was as good as embedded in the Israeli army before his son joined the IDF. Go back and read his coverage during the Gaza war, the attacks on Gaza. I remember reading 14 paragraphs in a row sourced to Israeli spinmeisters of various sorts, and maybe two or three paragraphs sourced to Palestinians. This is, I think, one of the most biased reporters who has ever dealt with this conflict in the New York Times, which is saying a lot, in my view. The idea that he was doing a great job beforehand is what makes me personally disturbed. He wasn't doing a great job. He was doing a terrible job. And if you compare his work with that of other Times reporters who cover this conflict, Isabel Kirshner covering it now, she tries to cover both sides of this conflict. Well, badly is another issue. Bronner never did that.
Bill Keller had an interesting response, the executive editor of the New York Times. He said, "My point is not that Ethan's family connections to Israel are irrelevant. They're significant, and both he and his editor should be alert for the possibility they would compromise his work. How those connections affect his innermost feelings about the country and its conflicts, I don't know. I suspect they supply a measure of sophistication about Israel and its adversaries that someone with no connections would lack." Again, this is Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, defending Ethan Bronner. He goes on to say, "I suspect they make him even more tuned in to the sensitivities of readers on both sides and more careful to go the extra mile in the interest of fairness." He writes, "I do know he has reported scrupulously and insightfully on Israelis and Palestinians for many years, and I have no doubt that if a situation arose that presented a real conflict of interest as opposed to an imaginary or hypothetical one, we would discuss it, and he would not hesitate to recuse himself."
Well, how having intimate connections to one side makes you more sensitive to the other side is beyond me. But I don't think Bill Keller's been reading the coverage that this man has been providing. I don't recall the date in January. I believe it was the 14th when he had a front-page story with a jump to an entire page on the inside. Those people who don't read a physical newspaper don't know what I'm talking about. And a dozen paragraphs in a row sourced to Israelis. How that is balanced coverage is beyond me. This has nothing to do with Arabs and Israelis. This has to do with reportorial standards. I mean, you quoted in an earlier segment Rabbi Marvin Heyer, and you gave him, in effect, he refused to come on your program, but you gave him an opportunity to say what he had to say about the petition that was submitted today in Geneva. That opportunity is not accorded to people on the other side of the conflict by Ethan Bronner. That's my beef with him, not that his son is in the IDF.
Hmm. Finally, let's end where we began, with the Manila Cemetery, and today what is happening in three cities, in Los Angeles, in Jerusalem, and Geneva. If you could just sum it up for us.
Should you sum up the website as well,
Rashid? Yeah,
we have a website.
I should. Of course, if I were a little more alert this morning, I would have had the website up for you, which it's now live. It's MamillaCampaign.org. Mamilla, M-A-M-I-L-L-A, campaign.org. I remembered it. Descendants of 15 families who have their ancestors buried in this cemetery with the assistance of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I should say, Rashid's daughter, Dima Khalidi, wrote the bulk of this. She's a second year out of law school. Incredible job. I should say that.
Presented a petition to several UN bodies in Geneva. And the launch included press conferences in Los Angeles, I think it's about to take place, a press conference right in front of the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, and a press conference in Jerusalem. I understand that after the press conference in Jerusalem, they're going to walk the journalists over to what's left of the cemetery. So 15 Jerusalem families have taken action with the help of the Center for Constitutional Rights to try and see to it that the desecration of the cemetery be halted.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us again, Professor Rashid Khalidi, Professor of Columbia University, and Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we're asking you to go to the phone. The number to call, as you are snowed in on this snowy day, you have no choice. Yes, we can demand that you make that call, because we know you're not doing anything else. Please call right now, 212-209-2950. Do it for WBAI. Do it for Democracy Now! Here on WBAI, 8 o'clock every morning, Monday through Friday. If you appreciate this broadcast, your call makes the difference. Again, that call is 212-209-2950. $50, $25, you become a member of WBAI. Michael, you're always pitching on WBAI. You can chime in here.
Well, actually, we pitched Monday.
You know,
Monday.
Michael Ratner hosts Law and Disorder.
And we did quite well, indicating that there's a lot of support out there for really...
It's a great show.
But where else are you going to get this kind of programming? I mean, where else are you going to hear a station talk about what's happening in West Jerusalem with Rashid Khalidi and to the Mamilla Cemetery? Where else are you going to get it? And so I've been supporter of WBAI, worked for it, done different things since the 1970s, defended it, done all kinds of things. So I encourage people to keep this station on the air in the best possible way it can so we can hear Rashid Khalidi again and again. And when he talked about, when you asked him the question about the New York Times, it was such a great answer because it wasn't saying, look, whatever they want to do about his son is one thing. Let's look at his coverage. Where else are you going to hear that in this country?
So go to your phones.
Absolutely.
Let us know that you're there. Let us know that you're standing up for independent media. Let us know that Democracy Now! Matters in your life. And Professor Khalidi, I understand your son has just, he won a national award for playwrights.
He did. He won a couple of awards for the play that's currently showing in Atlanta until 21st of February.
And it's called?
It's called Tennis in Nebris.
And it is about?
It is set during the last stage of the 1936-39 revolt in Palestine, and it's about how one family deals with this issue, how the British behaved, something that people don't know very much about. And it's both achingly sad and very funny, actually.
Is it coming to New York?
Well, if it does well enough in Atlanta, so people should buy their tickets on Delta and go on down there. And
it's supposed to be great.
Airports are closed today. I'm not
sure. Well, tomorrow. You can't get tickets for tonight.
Nablus just reminds me of a funny story. I went to Israel when I was 13, 1956, and I lived with an Israeli family. And it was very poor then, and we played Monopoly. And the Monopoly board was just put on a piece of cardboard or paper, and around it were all the cities, including all of the cities in the West Bank, including Nablus. So you could land your piece on Nablus and basically buy Nablus. This is in Tel Aviv in 1956. So what we're seeing today, certainly the logic of occupation, I guess is the way you would call it. But anyway, tennis in Nablus, I'd be really interested in seeing it. I hope it gets here.
You've got to go down there and see it, Michael. I just came back. I saw three successive performances, each one better than the last. Of course, I'm his father, I would say that.
And his full name is?
His full name is Ismail Khalidi. And I hope he'll be coming to New York with this play or another one of his plays.
Well, I thank you both for being with us. We're going to switch gears right now, but we ask you, even as we switch gears, though we are talking about a family affair at this point, we ask you to call right now, 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Give us a call. Let us know that you're there. Let us know you're standing up for independent media. Your call makes a difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. We're going to turn now to a fascinating book. As the Olympics open in Vancouver, we're turning to a Vancouver physician. His name is Gabor Mate. And speaking of family relations, Dr. Gabor Mate is the father of our producer, Aaron Mate. He is a best-selling author in Canada of four books. Among them, or the latest, is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. And it is a fascinating look at addiction. He works in Vancouver at the only safe legal heroin injection site in North America. And he has very interesting views of addiction. We thought it would be particularly interesting as the Olympics are taking place. He's talking about the lack of resources that are going in to help people in Vancouver who need the help. And also as the Obama administration's budget proposal for the Office of National Drug Control Policy sets aside nearly twice the amount of funding for law enforcement and criminalization than for treatment and prevention of drug addiction. To be specific, out of a total of $15.5 billion, some $10 billion are used for enforcement. The National Drug Control Policy Czar, Gil Kerlikowski, praised the numbers as reflecting a balanced and comprehensive drug strategy. At the same time, he says, people see a war as a war on them. We're not at war with people in this country. Well, we turn now to Dr. Gábor Maté. He has spent 12 years working with one of the densest populations of drug addicts in the world. He's a staff physician at the Portland Hotel, a residence and harm reduction facility in Vancouver, in Canada's downtown east side. Dr. Gábor Maté has written these four best-selling books, number one in Canada. It shows the power of the sound barrier. You know, borders should not prevent the transport of ideas back and forth. But we think it's critical for people in this country to hear what Dr. Gábor Maté is talking about in Canada. So we're going to go back to an interview I did with him a few days ago here in our studio. He's now back in Vancouver. Let's just go to the whole thing. And if you want to call now, the phone calls come in fast and furious for his book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, and the DVD of our entire interview. You can call right now and make your pledge to WBAI. 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference as we turn to Dr. Gábor Maté and the interview we did. Welcome to Democracy Now,
Pleasure
Dr. Maté. Now, what do you mean the only safe injection site, the only legal injection site in North America? People inject heroin there?
People are allowed to bring their drugs there. We don't provide them with their drugs. I think we should, but we don't. But they bring it in, and without fear of being arrested, they're allowed to inject under supervision. And the staff, without being fear of arrested, are allowed to help them inject in a safe way, give them clean needles, sterile swabs, and resuscitate them if they overdose. So everywhere else in Canada or in states, of course, these activities would all be illegal.
Why are they allowed to do this?
Well, it was conceived at a moment of political openness because so many people pass on infections like HIV and hepatitis C to one another through injection use, sharing needles. They infect themselves with bacteria from their skin by using dirty water. So it's a harm reduction measure that in many studies have been shown to reduce the burden of disease and also the economic costs attendant to addiction to society.
And do you find that addicts can actually heal themselves or perhaps be able to get off heroin more easily by injecting there?
Well, the facility is not designed to treat addiction per se. It's designed to reduce the harm from it. It's a harm reduction measure. What we do find, though, is that we have a detox facility on the second floor, which is where I've been working, and people come from the injection facility to detox because they've been brought into contact with compassionate caregivers perhaps for the first time in their lives. These people all had very tough lives, and so for them to even contemplate receiving help takes a lot of trust.
Talk about the people you treat.
Well, the hardcore drug addicts that I treat, but according to all studies in the States as well, are without exception people who've had extraordinarily difficult lives. And the commonality is childhood abuse. In other words, these people all entered life under extremely adverse circumstances. Not only did they not get what they need for healthy development, they actually got negative circumstances of neglect. I don't have a single female patient in the downtown east side who wasn't sexually abused, for example, as were many of the men, or abused, neglected, and abandoned serially over and over and again. And that's what sets up the brain biology of addiction. In other words, the addiction is related both psychologically in terms of emotional pain relief and neurobiological development to early adversity.
What does the title of your book mean, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts?
Well, it's a Buddhist phrase. In the Buddhist psychology, there are a number of realms that human beings cycle through, all of us. One is the human realm, which is ordinary cells. The hell realm is that of unbearable rage, fear, terror, you know, these emotions that are difficult to handle. The animal realm is our instincts and our id and our passions. Now, the hungry ghost realm, the creatures in it are depicted as people with large empty bellies, small mouths, and scrawny thin necks. They can never get enough satisfaction. They can never fill their bellies. They're always hungry, always empty, always seeking it from the outside. That speaks to a part of us that I have, and everybody in our society has, where we want satisfaction from the outside, where we're empty, where we want to be soothed by something in the short term, but we can never feel that or fulfill that insatiety from the outside. Addicts are in that realm all the time. most of us are in that realm some of the time. And my point really is that there's no clear distinction between the identified addict and the rest of us. There's just a continuum on which we're all maybe found. They're on it because they've suffered a lot more than most of us.
Can you talk about the biology of addiction?
For sure. You see, if you look at the brain circuits involved in addiction, and that's true whether it's a shopping addiction like mine or an addiction to opiates like the heroin addict, we're looking for endorphins in our brains. Endorphins are the brain's feel-good, reward, pleasure, and pain-relief chemicals. They also happen to be the love chemicals that connect us to the universe and to one another. Now, that circuitry in addicts doesn't function very well. As the circuitry of incentive and motivation, which involves the chemical dopamine, also doesn't function very well. Stimulant drugs like cocaine and crystal meth, nicotine and caffeine, all elevate dopamine levels in the brain, as does sexual acting out, as does extreme sports, as does workaholism and so on. Now the issue is, why do these circuits not work so well in some people? Because the drugs in themselves are not surprisingly addictive. And what I mean by that is that most people who try most drugs never become addicted to them. And so there has to be susceptibility there. And the susceptible people are the ones with these impaired brain circuits. And the impairment is caused by early adversity rather than by genetics.
What do you mean, early adversity?
Well, the human brain, unlike any other mammal, for the most part, develops under the influence of the environment. So, and that's because, from the evolutionary point of view, we develop these large heads, large forebrains, and to walk on two legs, we have a narrow pelvis. That means large head, narrow pelvis, we have to be born prematurely. Otherwise, we would never get born. The head already is the biggest part of the body. Now, the horse can run on the first day of life. Human beings aren't that developed for 2 years. That means much of our brain development that in other animals occurs safely in the uterus, for us, has to occur out there in the environment. And which circuits develop and which don't depend very much on our environmental input. When people are mistreated, stressed, or abused, their brains don't develop the way they ought to. It's that simple. And unfortunately, my profession, the medical profession, puts all the emphasis on genetics rather than on the environment, which, of course, is a simple explanation. It also takes everybody off the hook.
What do you mean it takes people off the hook?
Well, if people's behaviors and dysfunctions are regulated, controlled, and determined by genes, we don't have to look at child welfare policies. We don't have to look at the kind of support that we give to pregnant women. We don't have to look at the kind of non-support that we give to families, so that, you know, most children in North America now have to be away from their parents from an early age on because of economic considerations, and especially in the States because of the welfare laws. Women are forced to go find low-paying jobs far away from home, often single women, and not see their kids for most of the day. Under those conditions, kids' brains don't develop the way they need to. And so, if it's all caused by genetics, we don't have to look at those social policies. We don't have to look at our politics that disadvantage certain minority groups, so cause them more stress, cause them more pain. In other words, more predisposition for addictions. We don't have to look at economic inequalities. If it's all genes, we're all innocent, and society doesn't have to take a hard look at its own attitudes and policies.
Can you talk about this whole approach of criminalization versus harm reduction, mm-hmm. how you think addicts should be treated and how they are in the United States and Canada?
Well, the first point to get there is that if people who become severe addicts, as shown by all the studies, were for the most part abused children, then we realize that the war on drugs is actually waged against people that were abused from the moment they were born or from an early age on. In other words, we're punishing people for having been abused. That's the first point. The second point is that the research clearly shows that the biggest driver of addictive relapse and addictive behavior is actually stress. In North America right now, because of the economic crisis, a lot of people are eating junk food because junk foods release endorphins and dopamine in the brain. So that stress drives addiction. Now imagine a situation where we're trying to figure out how to help addicts would we come up with a system that stresses them to the max? Who would design a system that ostracizes, marginalizes, impoverishes, and ensures the disease of the addict and hope through that system to rehabilitate large numbers? It can't be done. In other words, the so-called war on drugs, which is the new drug czar points out, is a war on people, actually entrenches addiction deeply. Furthermore, it institutionalizes people in facilities where the care is very, where there's no care. We call it a correctional system, but it doesn't correct anything. It's a punitive system. So people suffer more, and then they come out, and of course they're more entrenched in their addiction than when they went in. And by the way, according to many studies, the easiest place to get drugs is in prisons. And in schools, by the way. These are the two areas where you can get drugs in North America, the schools and the prisons. So that it makes no sense from any point of view. It serves some people, perhaps, with entrenched interests, but it does not serve the addict, nor does it serve society. And I can tell you something else about that. A patient of mine with a $50 cocaine habit a day, which is not excessive, how does he raise money to be able to afford those drugs? By shoplifting. To raise $50 a day, he has to shoplift $500 worth of goods. Who pays for that? The social cost is way beyond the cost of law enforcement.
Wasn't there an attempt to shut down the clinic that you have in Vancouver by the federal government?
Well, the federal government we have in Canada right now, the Harper government, got its stuck head very much in the sands of Bush-era attitudes. And they never liked the idea of a supervised injection site, and they tried to shut it down. And twice now, in Supreme Court of British Columbia and in appeal court, their attempt has been defeated because the courts have ruled that this is a necessary medical service which the government does not have the right to withdraw. And of course, 24 international studies have attested to that, but the government ignores the medical information.
You're heading back to Vancouver, where the Olympics are beginning next
yes.
week. What is the effect of the Olympics on the community, especially when it comes to social services?
Well, in the downtown east side, there's a real fear, because the last time there was a big international event in Vancouver, which was Expo, the police simply took street people off the streets and shipped them out of Vancouver to put them on buses. Now, nobody's clear that that's going to happen this time, and probably not, because the political organization amongst people in the downtown east side is much stronger now. But certainly, I live in an area of the world where we're building highways now so that rich people can see skiing events, whereas social services are being cut. There's a danger of teachers being let go because of the typical North America-wide economic squeeze. And drug programs in northern British Columbia that serve Aboriginal youth have been cut now because of budgetary constraints. At the same time, we're building skating rinks. So it's usually the people at the very bottom who pay the price for the people who are well-to-do to have a good time.
I'm curious about your own history, Gabor Maté.
Yeah.
You've written a number of best-selling books. We won't get to talk about them all. I'm very interested in your one and how attention deficit disorder originates and what you can do about it. But about your own history, you were born in Nazi-occupied Hungary.
Well, ADD has a lot to do with that. I have attention deficit disorder myself. And again, most people see it as a genetic problem. I don't. It actually has to do with those factors of brain development, which in my case occurred as a Jewish infant under Nazi occupation in the ghetto of Budapest. And the day after the Nazis marched into Budapest in March of 1944, my mother calls the pediatrician and says, "Would you please come and see my son, because he's crying all the time?" And the pediatrician says, "Of course I'll come, but I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying." Now, infants don't know anything about Nazis and genocide or war or Hitler. They're picking up on the stresses of their parents. And, of course, my mother was an intensely stressed person, her husband being away in forced labor, her parents shortly thereafter being deported and killed in Auschwitz. Under those conditions, I don't have the kind of conditions that I need for the proper development of my brain circuits. And particularly, how does an infant deal with that much stress? By tuning it out. That's the only way the brain can deal with it. And when you do that, that becomes programmed into the brain. And so if you look at the preponderance of ADD in North America now, and the 3 million of kids in the states that are in stimulant medication, and the 500,000 who are on antipsychotics, What they're really exhibiting is the effects of extreme stress, increasing stress in our society, on the parenting environment. Not bad parenting, extremely stressed parenting because of social and economic conditions. And that's why we're seeing such a preponderance. So in my case, that also set up this sense of never being soothed, of never having enough, because I was a starving infant. And that means all my life I have this propensity to soothe myself. How do I do that? Well, one way is to work a lot and to get lots of admiration and lots of respect and people wanting me. If you get the impression early in life that the world doesn't want you, then you're going to make yourself wanted and indispensable. And people do that through work. I did it through being a medical doctor. I also have this propensity to soothe myself through shopping, especially when I'm stressed, and I happen to show up for classical compact music. But it goes back to this insatiable need of the infant who's not soothed, and they have to develop, or their brain develop, these self-soothing strategies.
How do you think kids with ADD, with attention deficit disorder, should be treated?
Well, if you recognize that it's not a disease, and it's not genetic, but it's a problem of brain development, and knowing the good news, fortunately, and this is also true for addicts, that the brain, the human brain, can develop new circuits even later on in life, and that's called neuroplasticity, the capacity of the brain to be molded by new experience later in life, then the question becomes not of how to regulate and control symptoms, but how do you promote development? And that has to do with providing kids with the kind of environment and nurturing that they need so that those circuits can develop later on. That's also, by the way, what the addict needs. So instead of a punitive approach, we need to have a much more compassionate, caring approach that would allow these people to develop, because their development is stuck at a very early age.
You began your talk last night at Columbia, which I went to hear at the law school, with a quote, and I'd like you to end our conversation with that quote.
Would that be the quote that only in the presence of compassion will people allow themselves
to... Mahfouz.
No. Yeah, Nagib Mahfouz, the great Egyptian writer, he said that nothing records the effects of a sad life so completely as the human body. So graphically as the human body. Right. And you see that sad life in the faces and bodies of my patients.
Well, Dr. Gábor Máté, I want to thank you very much.
Dr. Gábor Máté, please call right now and let us know you're in the house. He is a physician in Vancouver, Canada. His book is In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and we are offering you the book for a contribution of $75. It just came out in the United States. If you'd like to get our conversation with him on DVD, pledge $75. The book and DVD yours for $150 if you call right now. By the way, you can imagine on the snowy day that WBAI needs volunteers at 120 Wall. So if you're off work, I know a number of people don't have school, don't have work. Go on there if you can. You'll have tea and crumpets. You'll enjoy yourself, and you can help democracy. You can help WBAI with fundraising today. The number to call is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Now, let me tell you what we're offering. For a contribution of $75, you get In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, this remarkable book. For $75, you get the DVD of our conversation, my conversation with Dr. Gábor Máté. That's $150, the book and DVD. If you'd like to get his earlier book, you know, these books, number one bestsellers in Canada, but here... It is very hard to break the sound barrier, which is the border between Canada and the United States when it comes to ideas. If you appreciate hearing Dr. Gábor Máté, When the Body Says No is a very different book, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection. That book, When the Body Says No, is yours for $150. If you call right now and pledge, we will send you that book. It is not so easy to get these books here, and we want to make sure you get them. The book, When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection, is yours for $150. The book and DVD, his latest book, called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts and Our Conversation, is yours for $150. Put them together, though, for $250. You get both books and the DVD. If you call right now, we have raised over $1,000. We think we can get to $5,000, but only if you call right now. 212-209-2950. We're going to go back to a speech that Dr. Máté gave on this issue of addiction, on this issue of being in the realm of hungry ghosts. But in order to do that, we want to hear from you. Let's hear those phone calls coming in. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Your call counts. We need you. We welcome you to the airwaves of WBAI. We ask you to stand up for independent media. We cannot do it without you, only with you. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. Make it possible for WBAI to happen. We have a lot of people to thank. We're going to go to the speech of Dr. Mate, and we're going to include all of this on the DVD, the speech as well as the conversation. Please make your call. If you're listening on this snowy day and you appreciate Democracy Now!, well, please. We air Monday through Friday, 8 to 9, live here on WBAI. But what we're offering you are DVDs. You know, we're a TV show, too. If you ever miss WBAI's 8 o'clock broadcast of Democracy Now! At 6:30 and 1 in all five boroughs, if you live in, you know, Staten Island, Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx, or Manhattan. At 6:30 and 1, we're on CUNY TV. It's our colleagues at Educational Television, City University of New York. 6:30 and 1 on channel, it's 75 on Time Warner Cable. You can figure out the rest, RCN and the others, Vios and the others. Please call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes it all possible. We cannot do this without you. $250, you get both books and the DVD if you call right now. We cannot do this without you, only with you. We have had so many people calling in today, and it makes such a difference. If you appreciated the broadcast, we ask you to make the call now. 212-209-2950. We want to thank the person who called in from Greenwich, Connecticut, and Martin Melkonian, who called in. Thank you, Marty, for calling in from Uniondale. Paula Rogovin called in. Thank you, Paula, from Teaneck, New Jersey. Old friends, Patricia Chernoff called from Manhattan. Clara Nick Riquito called in from Piscataway. Thank you to the person who called in from Brooklyn, and to Judith Ann Block, who called in from Manhattan. To Bronxville, New York, we say thank you so much. Derek Thompson called in from the Bronx. Marjorie Bailey called in from the Bronx. John Manning Jr. called in from New City. Keep those phone calls coming in. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Fill the phone lines. If it takes a little time, that's okay. You've got it on the snowy day, I hope, but, you know, that's what it takes to support WBAI. Teaneck, New Jersey's in the house. Susan called from Brooklyn, and Hera called from Brooklyn. We got a call from New City, as well as Manuel Menendez called in from Manhattan. Thank you to the person who called from Manhattan, and Joe Vignata, who called in from Upton, New York. Keep those phone calls coming in on this snowy day. We need your support. We ask you to call. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, is yours for a contribution of $75. If you pledge right now, you'll get a copy of the DVD of speech and interview for a contribution of $75. Put them together for $150. If you would like to get an earlier of Dr. Mate's books, When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress Disease Connection, When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress Disease Connection, we ask you to go to the phone right now and let us know that you are there, that you're standing up for independent media. The two books and DVD are yours for $250, but only if you call now. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Fill those phone lines. I'm going to go now to Dr. Gabor Mate speaking about the issue of addiction in the realm of hungry ghosts, but keep those phone calls coming in. And by the way, if you want to do dinner and a show, I had a wonderful time last night with BAI listeners who had come in from New Jersey. Oh, we had a great time. It's a $2,000 contribution. You don't have to know when you can do this. You make the pledge right now. And then Brenda Murad, my colleague here at Democracy Now!, calls you, a wonderful person. She works out the details when it's convenient for you to come. You come to the set of Democracy Now! We had a full house today. They're on the set watching the broadcast. They met Danny Glover and Rashid Khalidi. They met Michael Ratner. All the folks who were here today, we had a wonderful day. You come to the set of Democracy Now! And I host you both for dinner. This is a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution. You could do it in the weeks or months to come. That is up to you. We urge you to call right now, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. We cannot do it without you, only with you. Please make that call. Remember, you just make the pledge. And then Brenda Murad, my lovely colleague at Democracy Now!, calls you. We work out the details of when you come. I host you for dinner, and you come to the set of Democracy Now!. But please make your call right now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. $2,000 keeps WBAI going. You give a gift to the whole community, especially on the snowy day. You make sure 99.5 FM is operating its full 50,000-watt broadcast signal atop the Empire State Building. Please make that call. 212-209-2950. Fill those phone lines. Let's go back to a few minutes of Gabor Mate and the speech that he gave on In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts.
Drug addiction can never be understood as long as we look at it through the lens of moralism, judgment, as long as we see it as a question of weak will, of people making bad decisions. What we forget is that for Sina and for every other addicted person in the downtown east side or anywhere in society, the drugs or the other targets of the addictive behaviors are not simply choices. In fact, they're hardly choices at all. And they're not certainly something to give them a good time or something that they employ for kicks. No, it goes much deeper than that. And to understand that, you see, if we ask the question, why is it that people, especially in the downtown east side, give up their health, give up their families, as Serena did, give up their lives, give up everything they've ever had, their relationships, their connections to the world, for the sake of the pursuit of the drug? What is the powerful appeal, the lethal hold of that drug experience? And it's easy to make a judgment about them as people, they're being weak-willed and so on. But then we ask ourselves, as a society, don't we have so many behaviors that are negative for us, that in fact are harmful to us as individuals, harmful to the society, harmful to the earth, and yet we persist? And then if you look at the life stories of somebody like Serena and ask the question, why is the heroin so powerful for her? Well, what is heroin? What is morphine? Primarily, of course, they're painkillers. So the real question is not why the addiction, but why the pain? And these medications or drugs are not only physical painkillers, of course, they're also emotional painkillers, because it turns out that the structure in the brain that interprets the emotional significance of emotional pain is the same one that interprets the emotional significance of physical pain. So when somebody says to you, when you said such and such to me, that really hurt me, they're not being metaphorical or poetic, they're being physiologically, anatomically quite correct, because the pain is interpreted in the same place in the brain. And so these drugs are not only painkillers from the outside, but they only work in the brain because we have receptors for them. We have molecules on the surfaces of our brain cells where these chemicals can bind and somehow relieve pain. But why do we have receptors for products derived from a poppy seed, such as heroin and morphine? Well, we don't. What we have are receptors for substances we ourselves manufacture and have in our bodies and our brains that look like morphine. So they're called endorphins, endogenous morphine-like substances. So why do we have endorphins? Well, clearly for pain relief, that's a major action of the endorphins that we have in our bodies. And when toddlers are running around, falling and bumping their behinds and their heads all over the place, and they get up and keep going, it's because at that stage of life, they're lucky enough to have a lot of endorphins in their system. Not like the rest of us. So pain relief is one role of the endorphins, but that's not the only one. They also give us a sense of reward, of pleasure. Any kind of thrilling activity will give us a rush of endorphins. That's why we find them thrilling, actually, because of our own rush of endorphins. But neither pain relief nor reward or pleasure are the major role of endorphins. The most significant role of endorphins, and this is the key to understanding all addictions, is actually connecting of the small, helpless infant to the parent. Without the endorphin system, there's no infant-parent attachment. When you rear young mice and you knock out their endorphin receptors in their brains by genetic selection, those young animals will not vocalize distress if they're separated from their mothers. And that means that in the wild they would die. because the most essential dynamic in human life is connection with a nurturing adult.
You've been
without
listening
that,
to
the human infant or any mammalian infant just
and
doesn't
I'm sorry for
the
sound quality. It's a little bit odd, but we're going to get you a much better DVD. The DVD is the full conversation that I have with Dr. Mate, as well as a speech that he gives on this issue. In the realm of hungry ghosts, Dr. Gabor Mate is a physician who looks at addictions. In the realm of hungry ghosts, his latest book looks at addictions, how they work, who experiences them, what can be done. The book is a survey of scientific evidence on addiction, but it's haunted by Mate's patients who are wrestling with poverty, violence, mental illness, drug addiction. We read about the depths of addiction, but also the persistence of humanity under the worst of conditions, that the well-off and the destitute are considered together in this book, reminds us that addiction transcends class, so said the Gazette of Montreal. In the realm of hungry ghosts is a compassionate look at drug addiction by best-selling author and physician Gabor Mate. The insightful book explores the scientific and psychological causes of addiction, as well as the impact on the addicts treated at the downtown Eastside Vancouver clinic, where Mate is a physician. He widens the lens to address the larger societal problems, speaking also to the risks of more high-status addictions like wealth, power, and sex. He boldly challenges the war on drugs, proposing a more holistic, constructive set of alternatives. A riveting, debate-provoking book about an illness that reaches all levels of society. In the realm of hungry ghosts provides a much-needed glimpse of hope from an innovator who's taking on addiction with unprecedented efficacy. We ask you to call right now. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. Your call counts. This book is number one bestseller in Canada. We wanted to break the sound barrier here in the United States. It's a deeply personal, as well as political, as well as scientific book about addiction at every level. We urge you to call right now and let us know that you are there. We ask you to stand up for independent media. We ask you to let us know that you are in the house. 818-985-5735, 818. Rather, sorry, I was just pitching on KPFK, 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Please make your call. Make WBAI possible. We only have a few minutes. We are offering you Gabor Mate's books and DVD. When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection is a remarkable book as well. We didn't even get into it very much at all in the conversation. We're going to bring you part two of that conversation with Gabor Mate. But When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection is remarkable. And both books and the DVD are yours for a contribution of $250. And remember, BAI needs help today. If you can trudge your way in to 120 Wall Street, they could really use your help, and you'll get some warm tea and crumpets. But think about going to help out BAI at Wall and South. They need your support. But When the Body Says No is yours for a contribution of $150. Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection. Can a person literally die of loneliness? Is there a connection between inhibited emotion and Alzheimer's disease? Is there a cancer personality? Questions such as these are emerging as scientific findings throw new light on the controversy that surrounds the mind-body connection in illness and health. Modern research is confirming the age-old wisdom that emotions profoundly affect our physiology. Repressed emotions frequently bring on stress, which in turn can lead to disease. Provocative and beautifully written, When the Body Says No provides fresh information regarding these and other important issues concerning the effects of stress on health. In lucid, easy-to-follow language, Dr. Gabor Mate summarizes the latest scientific findings about the role that stress and individual emotional makeup play in an array of diseases, including heart disease, diabetes, irritable bowel syndrome, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, cancer, and ALS, among others. Emotions like anger share with our immune system the role of defending our boundaries. When we repress emotions, we may also suppress our immune defenses. In some people, these defenses may go awry, destroying the body rather than protecting it. Dr. Mate explores the reason why, despite a rapidly accumulating body of evidence about the mind-body unity, most physicians continue to treat physical symptoms rather than persons, and why we must understand the mind-body link in order to take an active role in our overall health. When the Body Says No promotes learning and healing. It offers the kind of transformative insight that promotes physical and emotional self-awareness.
the lack of which, Dr. Mate asserts, is at the root of much of the stress that chronically debilitates health and prepares the ground for disease. 818-985-KPFK is the number to call. 818-985-5-7-rather-oh-God-why-oh-my-I'm-so-sorry. My brain is tracked into L.A. this morning. 212-209-2950. You don't have to call long distance. You can stay huddled in your house on this snowy morning and make your pledge to WBAI. The number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And Joe Vignola, thanks so much for calling. Please call. Keep the phone calls coming in. 212-209-2950. Let us know you're there. Let us know you're standing up for independent media. Your call counts. When the body says no is yours for $150. The two parts of the conversation, only one part you've heard today. The second part will be on the when the body says no, stress, disease connection. The first, in the realm of hungry ghosts. The DVD and the book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, is yours for $150. The brand new book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, as well as the DVD, are yours for $150. And that DVD includes a speech, an extended conversation with Dr. Mate. We urge you to call right now. Book and DVD, $150. When the Body Says No, his earlier book, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection, is yours for $150. Put them together for $250. You get both books and the DVD. 212-209-2950. Keep those phone calls coming in. Fill the phone lines. We cannot do this without you. Only with you. Your call counts. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Make that call now. Thank you for that call. And if you want to do dinner and a show, think of these snowy nights. What better thing to do than sit and have a great meal? Talk about the issues of the day. We can talk about what Dr. Gabor Mate is talking about in the realm of hungry ghosts or any other issue you'd like to talk about, our coverage of Haiti and all the other issues, the Mamila Cemetery that we were just talking about with Rashid Khalidi and Michael Ratner. Please call right now. 212-209-2950. Hey, Chris Dinas, thanks so much for calling us from Huntington. It's so nice to know that Long Island is listening on this snowy day. Oh, what a blast from the past, Dorothy. Alan has called in from the Bronx. Keep the phone calls coming in. You make the difference. We're trying to raise $5,000 today. If you want to do dinner and a show, just think about it. It's truly amazing. We had a wonderful time last night and this morning because folks came for dinner last night. We had just a long, relaxed, interesting dinner. And this morning they came to the set. They met everyone who came in today. They hung out with Danny Glover. He stayed later at the end of the show, Professor Khalidi and Michael Ratner. They meet the whole team that makes Democracy Now! Happen. Please call now. You pledge $2,000. You don't have to know when you can do dinner and a show. Then Brenda Murad, my colleague here at Democracy Now!, calls you. Works out the details when it's convenient. It could be this weekend, next week, next season. It could be next year. You come to the set. You watch the broadcast. I host you both for dinner because it's for you and your special guest, whoever that might be, your partner, a friend, a family member, someone you want to treat for a birthday or just for being them, an anniversary, and most importantly, you're supporting BAI in a huge way. Keep those phone calls coming in. We have just a few more minutes. The number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Prima Tamburiani, thank you so much for calling in from Manhattan and making that pledge. Thank you so much to Patricia Chernoff, and thank you to Brian Roche, who called in from West Hampton, is in the house. Ancy Stoney, John Moran, Arlene Hemingway called in from Amityville. Thank you, Arlene. Can we hear from Lindenhurst, Hopog, Copaic, Huntington, Babylon, Bayshore, Islip, East Islip, West Islip, Islip Terrace? If you live in Brookhaven, or if you live in Brentwood, or if you live in Brooklyn, we're asking you, please make that call. If you live in the Bronx, we need your support. If you are feeling brrr this morning, all the BRs, right? Give us a call and let us know that you're there. But again, if you want to do $2,000 dinner and a show, you make that pledge. It is tax deductible. It's a charitable contribution. You just make the pledge and we get right in touch with you and work out when it'll be convenient for you to come to the set and what an amazing time we have together. amazing way for me and you to honor WBAI and support it in a big way. Keep those phone calls coming in, folks. We're at $3,000. One person pledges $2,000, we'll hit our goal. If we've ever helped you hit a goal in terms of getting information, we ask you to call. This week's column that I wrote, I do a column every week for newspapers for, and this week, the title is called Haiti, Forgive Us. You know how all the G7 leaders were saying, we forgive Haiti's debt? Well, the question is not, do we forgive Haiti, but does Haiti forgive us? So it's very important to forgive the debt. It's just such a strange way of putting it. We have to look at the history of Haiti. By the way, your newspaper can run the column. Just ask your newspaper to run it. Over 100 do. You can find it at truthdig.com. Yeah, you can find it at democracynow.org, often on the Huffington Post and other places, but in newspapers as well. But we have to look at the serious U.S. troubled relationship with Haiti. We urge you to call and let us know that you're there, that you're standing up for independent media. But right now, if you appreciated the broadcast from Reed Lindsay on the ground in Port-au-Prince, speaking to you on satellite, that generator growling in the background, so it made it a little hard to hear, but to have that satellite broadcast from Port-au-Prince was amazing. Moving on to Danny Glover, just made it here to New York in the snow this morning to the documentary, and then on to Professor Khalidi and Michael Ratner. I mean, if you appreciate these voices, and on to Gabor Mate on this snowy day, what else can we bring you? We ask you, please, to give back to WBAI. That airs Democracy Now! Every day, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 every morning. If you appreciate this broadcast call, the number to call is 212-209-2950. Join the listeners who have called. We have 1 minute to go. We ask you to be as generous as you can. And we'll send you a life-changing book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. It's not just about addiction to drugs. It is about addiction to drugs, but not just. To wealth, to sex, to power, all of the addictions and how they're linked. It's an amazing book, Close Encounters with Addiction, Gabor Mate. The book and the DVD are yours for $150. We offered this on KPFK in Los Angeles. It blew the roof out. So many people called for it. We want to make sure we have enough books for you. The book and DVD are yours for $150. If you want to add Gabor Mate's book, When the Body Says No, Understanding the Stress-Disease Connection, that book is yours for $150, the earlier book, When the Body Says No. I'm in the midst of all of these books, and they've just been astonishing. I went up to see Dr. Mate at Columbia the other day. He gave a speech at the law school. Both books and DVD are yours for $250 if you call right now, and we're just about out of time. Thank you for being there. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950.
And that's a number you can continue to call. We'll have another episode of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman coming right up here at WBAI New York. If you're tuning in for Hour of the Wolf, which would be about halfway through now, Jim Freund will return next week. We're winding down our fun drive, currently scheduled to end on Tuesday, and we're getting very close to our goal. Thanks to everyone who has called in and pledged. And if you have not yet done so, how about sometime over this weekend? And we'll get to the end of our fundraising drive. It's 6:02, and we present next another episode of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman here on WBAI New York.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. And we ask you to go to the phone. WBAI needs your support. Today, Haiti special, as the UN coordinator on emergency relief says they failed Haiti, or at least they could have done a better job. This is pressure mounts, people needing food, needing water, needing shelter. We urge you to go to the phone right now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Today, we're going to play you a longer excerpt of Haiti Killing the Dream, the leader of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Why did you get involved with this project?
Well, I got involved because I'd been to Haiti several times in the 1990s for the New York Daily News. In fact, where you and I met there for the first time around that time, and I'd written a series of columns, and then I was approached by the producers for the film and the director of the film, Hart Perry, and asked to join in, and they'd already done quite a bit of the footage. They needed someone to work on the script for the film, and so we collaborated on the effort. It took a few years, actually, a lot of battles with PBS eventually before they, because, you know, PBS tries to do a lot of editing on a project even after it's done to make it palatable for their audience. But finally, the film was made and was pretty successful and won a couple of film, the Montreal Film Festival and a couple of other film festival awards, and was shown on PBS.
And it really was an amazing film, the documentary, and we're really thrilled that we can offer it to folks. If you call in right now, the documentary is called Haiti Killing the Dream. We're going to bring it to you now, and we're going to bring you two documentaries. One is Haiti Killing the Dream, and that goes up through the coup against Aristide, but the whole history, starting in 1804, Haiti is born out of a slave rebellion. The U.S. will not recognize it for decades because of slave-owning politicians in the Congress, afraid that it would inspire slaves in the United States, and goes right on up through, you know, the whole Lavalas movement, the sweeping out of the despots, and then this CIA-backed coup for 3 years, Aristide out of power. And the second film is K.K. Kane's Resistance, an amazing pièce de résistance, I think you could call it, that really focuses on the coup and beyond and deeply immerses you in Haitian culture, but documents what exactly the U.S. role was in that coup, what was happening through those years, you know, down to the names and the people. And the first documentary, Haiti Killing the Dream, that Juan wrote the script for, among others, Noam Chomsky is interviewed. And the second, Resistance, Alan Nairn, who had done a lot in exposing the CIA goings on and backing of the coup leaders like Emmanuel Constant, the head of FRAP, which means to punch, and that was paramilitary death squad responsible for the killing of so many thousands. So we're going to play for you now Killing the Dream. But we are offering you Haiti Killing the Dream for $100, Resistance for $100. And then our three DVD set from Democracy Now on our journey to the epicenter when Sharif Abdelkaddous and I and Elizabeth Press, Kim Ives, went down to Haiti right after the earthquake to see what was happening and to bring it to you vividly on DVD. Those three DVDs are yours for $150. The two documentaries are yours. That would be $350. But for $250, we give you the five DVDs, Haiti Killing the Dream, Resistance, and our triple DVD set from Democracy Now!, Journey to the Epicenter of the Quake. The number to call is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Please make your call now and fill the phone lines. We cannot do this without you, only with you. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Let's go to an excerpt of Haiti Killing the Dream, which, by the way, is narrated by the late, great actor and activist, Ossie Davis.
Haiti is the poorest and most volatile country in the Western Hemisphere. At least 75% of the adult population is illiterate and unemployed. After years of poverty and oppression, the Haitian people finally found a voice to rally them. After we passed 1804, we said we were independent, but did we truly have our freedom? When you tell me you are living in hunger, can you tell me that you are free? Jean-Bertrand Aristide's story, the saga of a priest who became president, is also the story of Haiti's first grassroots movement for democracy, Lavalas, which means a cleansing flood. When the rain is falling, is it just one drop that falls? Many drops fall? When many raindrops fall, they turn into a river. And if several rivers come together and go down, they make a flood. The The Lavalas movement and the flood of people power it unleashed have roots in the history of suffering of the Haitian people. Haiti is located on the western part of the island Hispaniola, which it shares with the Dominican Republic. The French turned it into their most profitable slave colony. But in 1791, the slaves revolted. By 1804, the slave armies defeated Napoleon's legions, making Haiti the first independent black republic in the world. Fearing the example would spread, the United States refused to recognize Haiti, beginning an uneasy relationship between a country founded by slaves and one founded by slave owners. At the turn of the century, America's view of Haiti was summed up by Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, who said, "Dear me, think of it, niggers speaking French."
You know, more than 2 years before we entered World War I, we decided we had to control Haiti.
Here's Port-au-Prince, Haiti, in 1915, chief city of an island nation torn by internal troubles. Behind these scenes of peace and semi-tropic tranquility, there's uneasiness and unrest.
The U.S. government wanted to control the strategic Windward Passage between Haiti and Cuba, the major shipping route to the Panama Canal and the Pacific. So they created a pretext to justify a military intervention.
And then in 1915, United States Marines land in Haiti to battle Haitian bandits threatening destruction of American properties. And native bandits quickly head for the hills. This puts immediate end to troubles in populated areas, but Marines prepare to drive into interior and rout the insurgents out.
The arrogance with which we went about it, when you think of a young Franklin Delano Roosevelt as an assistant secretary of the Navy, bragging. I can see him there bobbing on the deck now, and he's writing the Constitution for the free people of Haiti. There can't be a more imperialist mentality than that. These people are too dumb to write their own constitution. I have to do it for them.
Haiti's own Darty Guanave is elected provisional president, and the riot-ridden republic begins to function as a nation once again. Here are troops of the Palace Guard, but United States Marines are ever present.
It was a murderous, bloody intervention which destroyed the constitutional systems, reinstated slavery. The Marines stayed there for 20 years. What they left behind them was a military force, a National Guard, which essentially took over and has been run and ran it under one or another dictatorship since.
In 1957, the United States propped up the regime of Haiti's most feared president, François Duvalier. Known as Papa Doc, he was a country doctor who became a despot. To ensure he would not be overthrown by the army like his predecessors, Papa Doc built up his own vigilante militia, the infamous Tonton Macoutes. Volunteers for the Macoutes were paid by having free license to steal and extort from the people they tortured, raped, and murdered. Toward the end of his life, Duvalier cemented his ties to Washington and arranged for his son, Jean-Claude, to succeed him. After Papa Doc's death in 1971, 19-year-old Baby Doc took over as president for life. Baby Doc plundered the national treasury and, with army support, turned Haiti into a major drug transshipment stop. In 1986, a popular uprising ended the three decades of Duvalier dictatorship. Baby Doc was flown into exile aboard a U.S. government jet, taking a vast fortune and leaving behind a devastated but relieved country. After years of living in fear, the Haitian people exploded. taking revenge on the most abusive Tonton Macoutes in the déchoucage or uprooting of the Duvalier oppression. Some Macoutes who committed capital crimes suffered the popular justice called Père Lebrun, or necklacing. A tire filled with gasoline was placed around their bodies and burned.
The transitional government that was named after Duvalier, Jean-Claude Duvalier, fell was an army-led government, the CNG. And the army has shown little willingness to stay out of political affairs since then. There have been 7 or 8 coups since 1986, and the army has been involved in every one of them.
They sing, "Nothing has changed. Things are still the same. The soldiers have become Macoutes and are breaking heads."
Dom la e pason la ye. On ma kout ki bezwen la ye, wavin la ye sou dom. Dom la e pason la ye. Dom la e pason la ye.
Despite signs of deepening army entrenchment, the country tried to hold elections in 1987. They were destroyed by the military and the Macoutes, who slaughtered voters as they tried to cast their first ballot. At the same time, a young Catholic priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, began drawing attention for his outspoken criticism of the army and foreign domination of the country. Inspired by the Latin American Church's liberation theology, Aristide was dedicated to helping the poor. He worked for years with orphans in the vast shantytown La Saline, where he was affectionately called Titide.
Ce moment de plénitude, j'ai surpris un élan de la vie. Ce moment de plénitude, j'ai surpris un élan de la vie.
In 1988, as Aristide said Mass, his church, Saint Jean Bosco, was attacked and burned by armed thugs.
When the mass began, there were many people who began to run, scatter. Many Tonton Macoutes who have red bandanas here on their arms and pistol in their hands. Machetes, daggers, knives, and they killed many people. More than 38 people fell here on the ground inside Saint Jean Bosco Church.
I was there waiting for death. And fortunately, I'm still alive. Fortunately. So I give my life to my brother and sister because it's love for me. And in French I say, because I already died, that's why I'm still alive.
I know Father Aristide very well. For us here in Haiti, Father Aristide is a savior. It is only he that can save Haiti from its miserable situation. Father Aristide and the poor are one.
nan menm tèt moun sa yo. Wè gran pil gro bourgeois. An pil riche. An pil moun.
On the top of the hills, there are lots of big bourgeois. Lots of rich people, lots of people with lots of money. The liberation of Haiti will be done with the cooperation and the participation of the rich and the poor who till the land. For together they will have dialogue. For together they will find a way for those who have none and those who have plenty to make the gardens grow more vegetables. So that the vegetables can sell better, so that there are machines to carry the vegetables instead of the head of the tired and exhausted peasant. Repeated violence by the army and the international outrage that followed finally forced the Haitian government to agree to a new election, this time monitored by the United Nations. That election, the country's first free vote, was held on December 16, 1990.
Can I ask who you're voting for president?
The U.S., which had backed another candidate, and Haiti's ruling class were shocked when Aristide, who had entered the race at the last minute, swept 67% of the balloting against 10 opponents.
Jeunesse Chalmay Peralta, est-ce que nous senti sans Chalmay Peralta couler dans vein nous?
Youth of Haiti, do you feel that there are valiant young men in the country? Do you think there are brave young women in the country? Have you decided to leave quarreling, back to back, dog eat dog, all together, helping each other, walking side by side, loving each other? No wonder I am so crazy about the young people. Thousands joined together to celebrate at Aristide's inauguration. The triumph of Lavalas, the people's flood, made it the first democratic movement in Haiti to win power.
Let me remember, I am the one who is following Haitian people instead to be the one who is leading in the way to say, oh, do that, don't do that. In Haiti, we could realize a political revolution on December 1691 without weapons, because we use our mind, because we use our heart, we could do that.
But Haiti's new day was not celebrated by all. Those who had enjoyed power and privilege in the past were troubled.
But the people has made a choice, and that is bringing all the trouble. And I think people calling it democracy, the fact that Aristide has been elected by 67% of the population, even of 70, I think, and it is a bad way of seeing democracy, because it can be a terrible miscalculation due to the fact that the people, you cannot depend on the people, which does not know how to read, to make a good choice.
One of the first goals of the Aristide administration was a nationwide literacy program. They also worked for AIDS education, a new minimum wage, and a long overdue land reform program. The Lavalas movement tapped a long neglected pride with people working together to rebuild and cleanse a devastated society.
You have to know that during 7 months, this government, we changed everything. We refused to the corruption. We refused the drug. We refused the contraband. Everything. It was a dream who came true for Haitian people. It's the reason why they wanted to kill that dream. And when they wanted to kill Aristide, they wanted to kill Haitian people.
On his speech in front of all the nation, he made the first mistake against the army by asking to resign 7 generals. That was for us a kind of signal saying that we were going to have trouble with this guy.
People will tell you the elites of the country were prepared from the day after his election to unseat him and were waiting for the appropriate moment. These people were angered because the privileges that they had long enjoyed were removed from them. Among those privileges, their right not to pay taxes, the right to sort of act as a law unto themselves. People claim that because Aristide had cracked down, or at least begun to crack down against contraband and drug trafficking, that elements involved in those two areas were particularly motivated against him.
The American embassy and community were also not happy with Aristide, who they perceived as a threat to their business interests.
Because I live here, I can't be afraid. I live here. I was a little worried of some of the things that he was saying. He was starting to try to make the populace understand that they were low because there was an aristocracy. Most of the populace here understand that without the aristocracy, they can't survive.
Mais toujours été gain des camps. Donc c'est pas Aristide qui prêchait l'idée des classes.
Two camps exist and always remain. It's not Aristide who preaches class struggle. It exists and can be seen in the country. Did Aristide say there are poor people and rich ones? Can't you see there are poor ones and rich ones? Don't you see there is a disparity, a sort of barrier between rich and poor? Therefore, Aristide does not preach class struggle. He simply remarks it's there. He is pointing the finger to say, look at misery. Look at the money being wasted. Is that preaching class struggle? Is it? When in actuality, it exists. He only points the finger at it to say, this should not be there. There should not be people so comfortable who are bathing in luxury. People have baths for the dogs while others have no water to drink. Is this class struggle?
In September of 1991, President Aristide addressed the United Nations.
Let the echo of the democratic creed resound around us also. We believe in these 10 democratic commandments. We believe in this democratic policy. We believe in the meeting at which there will be no minority on the table, nor any majority under the table, but all shall be around the democratic table. So be it, in the name of the people, and its sons, and its Holy Spirit. Amen.
Aristide's success on the world stage only hastened the plots against him. He had survived at least 4 assassination attempts. On his return from the UN, he was to be victim of one more, but his security team foiled the attempt at the airport. Aristide immediately rallied the people at the palace.
My sisters, my brothers, who are born in the bourgeoisie in Haiti, who do not like to see the bourgeoisie fight with the people and the people fighting with the bourgeoisie, but who also know that the bourgeoisie has to conform according to the laws of democracy and according to the rules of democracy.
He was saying that the last chance of rich people, because if after the weekend they don't move, they don't show clearly that they want to help. He was sorry for them.
I speak with you like this because I gave you 7 months to conform. And the 7 months are up today.
Could you describe the night of the coup?
On the Sunday at 9 o'clock, we began to hear the shouting. And when we realized it was a coup, I called Mr. Sedouas. And he told me that the soldiers was not happy. I say, it's not a reason why to make a coup. He say, madam, you don't understand nothing.
Colonel Raoul Cedras was promoted to Army Chief by Aristide in recognition of his supervision of the December 1990 election. Only 7 months later, he led the coup against the president.
Come on, these guys, you know what it is?
They're crazy, man. Be careful, man.
The coup happened on a Sunday night. The army was circulating around town saying, no, this is just a small little affair between the military. You can go back to your houses. And then Monday morning, they started driving around shooting people. I think a friend of mine went to the morgue on Monday morning and saw people there said there were 140 bodies in that particular morgue. I think people were shocked. They were shocked that such a thing would happen. They were shocked that Aristide was no longer here.
On the Monday of the coup, I've seen that 500 people were killed because they were killing on everybody in the street. They were like, I don't know how you say in English, but in French we say machine infernale.
What they wanted was to kill Father Aristide. And the first flaw of their plot was that they didn't succeed in killing him.
They shoot on my residence and then finally in the palace where they were shooting, and I was arrested. When I arrived in the headquarters of the army, Cedras was there and he said, now I'm the president. And he was a bit happy. He asked what he wanted, what he had to do with me. And some of them say, well, we kill him, and some others, no. So they were divided.
In the wake of the coup, observers close to events questioned who was really behind the army uprising.
And all this thing about the little soldiers rising up, I think that's bullshit. I think it's all something that's been organized for a couple of weeks.
The famous Hotel Olufsen in Port-au-Prince is managed by Haitian-American Richard Morse.
There were no blackouts during the coup for a week, which means that they had to line up the generators, they had to get all the gas out there. And, you know, there was so much money. You're talking, I've heard, up to $47 million to pay for the coup. So you're talking about 16 to 18 families that put this money together. I don't think it's something they can do over 1 or 2 days.
With the pieces of information I have, I am absolutely convinced that the coup has been engineered by the American embassy. That's my profound conviction. Probably not the kind of coup we are saying.
That just sounds like the kind of traditional, foolish, totally unsubstantiated view that if there's a problem anywhere in the hemisphere, the United States is somehow responsible. We help promote these elections, probably more than any government in the hemisphere.
The United States is joining most of the rest of the world in calling for the restoration of a democratically elected leader who's sitting right next to me.
Can it be done?
And that's the question that's before us right now. That's the right answer.
Thank you.
They've got to do their job, but you and I have to get our going, too. So.
There's very little correlation on these matters between what the United States officials say and what the government actually does. You can't see any conduct on its part that is designed to reinstate Aristide. If you watch its conduct before his election, it uniformly opposed him. It discouraged him from trying to run. It put money into the country to support opposition. It did everything it could, short of intervention, to defeat him.
Vie complot ça li sorti Washington, li passé Vatican, c'est bon Dieu voyou. Complot Aristide l'alte sorti Washington, li passé Vatican, c'est bon Dieu voyou.
Historic precedent and persistent rumors raised suspicions of covert U.S. involvement in the coup. Aristide supporters questioned the role of Ambassador Alvin Adams, who started his career in the U.S. Embassy in Saigon during the Vietnam War and later was assistant to Henry Kissinger in the Nixon White House. On the day of the coup, Adams helped arrange Aristide's quick departure to Caracas, Venezuela, where he was granted political asylum.
It's not just a question of Haitian people, it's a question of democracy throughout the world. So when the international community say they are with Haitian people, now it's time to see if they will pass from word to action.
The coup was condemned by most of the 1 million Haitians living abroad. Thousands took to the streets of Miami, New York, Boston, and Montreal, demanding that the United States support Aristide's return. The Organization of American States sent a delegation to Haiti to try and negotiate a settlement. But hardline officers, fearing Aristide's return, sent soldiers to the airport to disrupt the negotiations.
They are having a meeting to try and make a deal so that Aristide can come back, and we don't agree with this at all.
If they don't name a new president right away, this country will be reduced to ashes, and another people can come and live in it.
In what democracy the army can be so totally above the state, as though this country belongs to the army has a right to do whatever he wants. This army, which is a gangsterized army with drugs, they started again doing the same thing now, because that's the reason why they want the power.
We didn't do it this to get power, I mean political power from anybody, because that's not our mission. Our mission is just to be a professional institution without involving in political affairs. Hello? Oui, oui?
The military not only disrupted the OAS negotiations, but later the same day, they opened fire on Parliament, demanding that the legislators name a new government immediately. Joseph Nerret was hastily made president, and ex-Duvalier aide Jean-Jacques Honorat was appointed prime minister.
I call it an accident, and I call it an accident of infancy. Quite expectedly, and I expected this in the 16th of December, the baby had to have an accident at some point of time. It took only 7 months. It could have taken more, and it would have been worse. It would have been a bloodbath.
After the coup, the new leaders began a disinformation campaign to persuade world opinion that it was Aristide, not they, who had violated human rights.
The peaceful means to impeach Mr. Aristide were not possible to be used. because of Aristide's Père Lebon. You know what the Père Lebon is, the neck blessing fetish punishment. So a national institution stepped in.
When Silvio Claude, a populist politician, was killed on the day of the coup, the military blamed it on Aristide and turned the funeral into a major media event.
Silvio Claude was killed by Aristide. So Aristide is a criminal. Aristide is Satan in person. Lucifer. That's what Aristide is.
Qui fait Aristide va faire exil? C'est Silvio Claude qui est la gagne dans la rue pour Aristide va faire exil. Pour nous Aristide manger Silvio Claude.
Il faut trouver des justifications.
Justification for the coup d'état must be found. If facts aren't available, they have to be invented. Silvio Claude died on the night of the coup d'état in Lekai. Silvio Claude was in the hands of the army, and his body should be examined to see if it has bullet wounds.
Et il aurait fallu voir son corps pour voir s'il n'avait
since
pas
since he was in the hands of the army, it's the army which should be asked why he was killed, not Father Aristide who was in
Port-au-Prince.
The international community condemned the military coup, and the OAS isolated the new regime with an embargo. The embargo has paralyzed Haiti's already atrophied economy, but it has failed to dislodge the coup leaders from power. The Bush administration, claiming concern for Haitian jobs, lifted the embargo on American assembly plants.
The U.S. formally opposed the coup. My assumption is that it is waiting for an appropriate moment to find a way to restore to dominance in the society, the wealthy business classes and the military, who are the natural U.S. allies, because they will ensure stability. They'll help Haiti become part of the Caribbean system that the U.S. is trying to create, a system which provides super cheap labor, which will be our East Asia, basically.
Aristide's proposal to raise the minimum wage from $3 to $5 a day antagonized both American and Haitian business leaders.
Aristide never brought the climate that would be advantageous for investment or for business expansion. All to the contrary, there was continuous threats on what he calls the bourgeois patriot and the bourgeois patrie poche. And there were definitely a lot of threats against me. My view on that is that Aristide should perhaps return. But he should return to be judged. He should return to be tried.
With the economy in shambles, most Haitians still believe their hopes for democracy and a better life are linked to Aristide's return.
The thing is, we voted only for one president. We are waiting for him. He must return.
Why wouldn't we want him to return? We were secure then, do you understand? We had great hope, we had great hope. But right now, what hope? Right now, it's as if they've already dug our graves.
Either Aristide returns or he doesn't. Understand? It's him we are waiting for. I know I have suffered a lot for him. I'm not there for the money. I have a trade. I have a right to live in my country. It is he who showed me the vote. Now it's dog eat dog. I would prefer killing myself if he were not to return. I'm very happy there's no gas.
Despite the embargo, oil tankers continue to arrive in Port-au-Prince, and the wealthy get what they need from across the Dominican border. But the poor, who many suggest are suffering the most from the embargo, are still its most ardent supporters.
We are suffering it too, but it's the big shots who are suffering also. I believe they will start suffering before me because we are used to touch light and everything else. We are resigned to take it. But it's our speed who must return here.
We will use pine wood. We will use touch light. We are used to eating leaves. We will eat leaves. We have sweet potato buds. We know how to use the land. We'll find sweet potato balls.
Don't you see how much weight I've lost? Since Aristide left, I've lost a lot of weight.
Look, every day I hear the clock strike bang at 12. I think Aristide's return. I'm so happy. Progressive Catholic parishes remain rallying points for Aristide supporters.
Oh Lord, you gave him to us. You chose him. You gave him to us because you saw that we deserve him. And now a group of villains are putting him through the same thing they put Jesus through. And now, Jesus, you will send him back to us. We are dying. We cannot talk. Our mouths have been sealed. Our feet are tied. Our children cannot go into the street. We cannot do anything.
Oh Lord, look at what misery we're in. Liberate us because we have never forgotten your laws. Those who have betrayed the country are disgusting to us. Bishop Romulus of Jérémie has long been a courageous moral voice in Haiti. The Haitian army is the only master in this land. It does what it wants. It arrests people anytime it wants. It beats anyone it wants. It puts people in prison anytime it wants. This is the situation where people are cornered.
More violence every night because every day we find something new. And I don't like it anyway. Because me, myself, my wife, my children, we cannot sleep.
Oh my God. You're going to kill this guy.
For 1 month since they took President Aristide hostage, I haven't been able to eat or to sleep or to live because Aristide is not here. They forced young men of my age to flee, but now I've heard there is a UN delegation coming. And I wanted to take the chance with the world for President Aristide to hear me, how we in Jérémie are living.
My name is Ramsey Clark, and I'm with this very distinguished commission, the Haiti Commission for Inquiry into the September 30 coup d'etat. But our visit here has shown that at the moment, the whole country of Haiti is like a prison, and not just any prison, but a prison in which the people are terrorized. It's good to see you.
Hiding from the police in the Argentine embassy is Haiti's most renowned folk singer, Mano Charlemagne.
It's not for the first time they call me a subversive singer or a subversive man. If you are fighting for people or for poor liberation, you are subversive, and you know that.
What will happen if you leave this residency?
I'll be killed.
Complot Aristide l'a été sorti Washington, li passé Vatican, c'est bon Dieu que voyez. Si l'église la parle en magouille, si l'église pape servi à magouille, côté sacré que Jean-Paul 24, la l'école a dit l'église c'est changement. À l'école, à vive la révolution. À l'école, à non pas manger poisson. À l'école, à non pas prendre un complot.
Nous avons mis nos langues à crager pour nous attirer, mais nous avons mis nos pieds. C'est un coup de bâton pour là.
They came, they were going to shoot us, but then they hit us on the side of the face. Bon. And then, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Ok, ça c'est police. Ok, bon. Donc, je viens tout.
One guy had a Uzi in his hands, and they started to beat us. My father, my little brother too. And my father, they had to in the hospital and turn him, I guess, because he couldn't get up. They made us put our hands in the air and say, "Long live Jean-Claude Duvalier! Down with Aristide!"
How does it feel to be an internationally known human rights activist,
now involved in the government.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we are asking you to go to the phone. You've been listening to Ozzie Davis, the late great actor and activist, narrating this remarkable documentary called Haiti, Killing the Dream, presented by Jonathan Demme and Harry Belafonte. It aired on PBS. It was written by Juan Gonzalez. We ask you to go to the phone. Hart and Dana Perry were the filmmakers who document this incredible film, and then went back to Haiti during the coup at a time when it was very dangerous for filmmakers and journalists, but had, because they were documenting before, knew they had to return. We urge you to go to the phone. The film is yours for a contribution of $100. If you call now, 212-209-2950. I have so many people to thank. I ask you to call right now. And we are offering you a remarkable panoply of gifts. Haiti, Killing the Dream, written by Juan Gonzalez, brought to you by Crowing Rooster Productions, is aired on PBS. $100 contribution, understand the history of Haiti. Born of a slave rebellion in 1804, first black republic established in the world, not recognized by the United States for decades because of slave-owning politicians not wanting their own slaves to be inspired by Haiti. We urge you to call 212-209-2950. But we're not stopping here with this documentary for a $100 contribution. If you would like to get Resistance, a second documentary, it's by K.K. Kane, Catherine Kane, a remarkable film that goes from the coup in 1991, deeply immerses you in the culture of Haiti, with interviews with people, oh, like Alan Nairn, who really exposed the CIA backing of the coup at that time, and others. We urge you to call right now. In Haiti, Killing the Dream, Noam Chomsky also interviewed to understand the U.S.-Haitian relationship, which is very important to understand today. Resistance is a real pièce de résistance. K.K. Kane did an incredible film. Both of those documentaries, either one is yours for 100. Together, they're 200. But then we also have our own journey to Haiti, journey to the epicenter of the quake. And that was right after the earthquake. I went with Sharif Abdelkaddous and Elizabeth Press, Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté. We went to Haiti and took this journey to the epicenter of the quake, from Port-au-Prince to Carrefour to Cressier to Léogâne. We ask you to go to phone. When the UN and U.S. said they had to ensure security before they went out, we were seeing security. People weren't rising up. People were digging down deep, covered in cement ash, clawing in the rubble to get to their loved ones, their grandparents, their babies, their wives, their neighbors. And the aid, people begging for water, for food, for some kind of shelter as the rains come now. And we bring you the 3-DVD set of our journey there, called Haiti, Journey to the Epicenter of the Quake. We ask you to go to the phone right now and let us know you're there. The number to call is 212-209-2950. That's a $150 contribution, the Democracy Now! Trilogy of DVDs. If you want to get both documentaries and the trilogy, pledge $250. That's just 20 and change a month. We ask you to call right now. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Make the call that makes a difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. And I have a lot of people to thank. Lawrence Timpson, thanks so much for joining and calling us from Pound Ridge. Omar Venegas called from the Bronx. Marianella Afridi called from Garden City. And we thank you so much for that pledge. Paula Rogovin, oh, thank you, Paula, for being there. Paula Rogovin called from Teaneck, New Jersey. Nikki Reich called from Brooklyn. Tim Curran called from Elmsford, New York. Folks, give us a call. Let us know you're there. Bloomfield, New Jersey is in the house in the person of Patricia Comstock. Thank you, Patricia. And Dr. Witherspoon called from Fort Lee, New Jersey. Thank you, Dr. Witherspoon. Keep those phone calls coming in. Rosie Tony called in from Manhattan, and we got an anonymous contributor from Springfield, New Jersey. Thank you, Springfield. Connecticut has called. New Canaan is in the house. Please keep those phone calls coming in. Please let us know that you're there. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Make the call that makes a difference. Make it possible for WBAI to happen. And we will send you the 5-DVD set on Haiti, past and present, and where we go from here. $240 contribution. If you want to understand Haiti today, so unbelievably hard hit, unimaginably hard hit. 250,000 people have died, on par with the tsunami which affected 9 countries. This is half of one island, just miles from our shore. And China was there before the United States was in Haiti. I mean, it's an astounding story. When Guantanamo, how close is Guantanamo, the closest landmass next to the Dominican Republic? We ask you to call right now and let us know that you're there. We ask you to stand up for independent media. We cannot do it without you, only with you. Please make your call. 818. The number to call is 212-209-2950, and we'll send you Haiti Killing the Dream, a remarkable documentary about the history of Haiti, narrated by Ozzie Davis. You do not want to miss this. We ask you to call right now. 212-209-2950. This is the last time we're doing this. In these final days of fundraising on WBAI, we ask you to be as generous as you possibly can. How important it is to make your contribution today. $100 gets you Haiti Killing the Dream. $100 gets you Resistance, which is really the sequel, I would say. Haiti Killing the Dream, with interviews with Noam Chomsky and others, documenting, as Ozzie Davis does, through the history, the 200 years of Haiti. We urge you to go to the phone and let us know that you're there. Well, not quite 200 years. It stops right about in 1991, right at the time of the first democratically elected leader, President Aristide, being ousted in a CIA-backed coup. And it gives you the whole history. And you understand the first U.S. occupation, 1915 to 1934, Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. Marines occupy Haiti and what that meant at the time, and then the first coup. And then Resistance goes from there and goes deeply, digs down into that coup and also into Haitian culture. These two films are beautiful, and they are informative, and they are political, and they are something to watch on a Saturday night instead of going out to a movie, invite friends over, have dinner, talk about what's happening, and decide what you want to do. Have a fundraiser for Haiti. We urge you to call right now and let us know that you're there. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes it all possible. And if you'd like to support WBAI, where you're hearing this documentary, and where else do you hear this kind of work than on WBAI? Well, then make a large contribution, if you possibly can, to BAI. As a wonderful person did 2 days ago, match that contribution of $2,000. It's tax-deductible charitable contribution, so we can continue to do this work, to drill down into the history and to look forward into the future and to describe what's happening on the ground today. All of those places, past, present, and future, together we journey. For a $2,000 contribution, you get dinner and a show. You come to the set of Democracy Now! You watch the broadcast 8 to 9 in the morning as it airs live on WBAI. You watch the broadcast. You meet the guests who are here. Last week, Danny Glover had just flown in from South Africa, where he'd met with President Aristide. He came into our studios. You would have hung with him that morning. Or Eve Ensler is coming in the next week. Eve, who I just remember when we were in Haiti a few weeks ago, was in our studio here in New York, and we were talking about Miriam Merlet, who died in the rubble of her house. A great feminist, a consultant for the women's ministry in Haiti, had just driven into her house 15 minutes before, right behind the Nader Art Gallery in Port-au-Prince. And Eve had called right before I left, said, please try to find Miriam. I understand she is trapped in her house, but we got there just as she was being buried down the street. And this is one. Miriam Merlet is one of a quarter of a million Haitians. It is such an astounding, unimaginable story. And now the UN is saying, well, maybe their UN relief activities were a little lacking, wanting. It's the people of Haiti who want, who need, and who deserve. This isn't about charity. This is about returning to Haiti all that has been taken and shoring up the people of Haiti so that they can help themselves, which they certainly can if they are given back. We ask you to go to the phone right now and let us know you're there. $240, get the 5 DVDs and play them. Give them to a library. If you pledge $2,000, you come to the set of Democracy Now!, you watch the broadcast. I host you for dinner, you and your special guest. It would be such an honor to sit down and toast WBAI and talk with you about whatever you'd like to talk about. Independent media in a time of war, in a time of this kind of catastrophe, health insurance in this country, about the environment, and talk about whatever you'd like. And this is a wonderful way to support WBAI. You come to the set of Democracy Now!, you watch the broadcast with your special guest, maybe your partner, a family member, a friend, someone you'd like to introduce to Democracy Now!, or someone who adores it already, and someone who wants to support WBAI. But you come to the set, you watch the broadcast, and then I host you for dinner. It's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution to WBAI, and you don't even have to know when you can do this right now. Just make the call, make the reservation. Then
Brenda Murad here at Democracy Now! Will get in touch with you and work out the details. When is it convenient for you to come? You could do it this week, next season, next year. You can say, call me back in a month. I'm not sure yet. You can say, can you do it in a few days? And all of that is yes. We ask you to go to the phone right now and let us know that you're there. The number to call is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Whether you can do $25 or $2,000, we ask you, please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Your call counts. We cannot do this without you, only together. We ask for your support. We need your support. We need you to be there for WBAI. $25 or more makes you a voting member of WBAI, and you can help to determine the future of your community radio station that is celebrating 50 years in your ears. 50 years of community, of building community. We ask you to call, because when you hear someone speaking for themselves, a Palestinian child or a Haitian grandmother or an Iraqi aunt or a grandfather from Afghanistan, it breaks down barriers. It builds community rather than advocating the bombing of bridges. It builds bridges. Please call right now, 212-209-2950. Whether you could do 25 or 100 gets you Haiti killing the dream. Another 100 gets you Resistance, which is really the sequel. It goes deeply into the coup years of 1991 to 94 and into the culture of Haiti. It's a magnificent film. Those two for $200, or the Democracy Now! DVD trilogy, journeying with us to Haiti after the earthquake, and you see a most astounding DVD set, and you journey with us to Haiti. We ask you to call right now, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes the difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Your call counts. Make that call right now, 212-209-2950. Keep the phones coming in. We cannot do this without you, only with you. Please call right now, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen, and we will send you Haiti Killing the Dream. That's narrated by Ozzie Davis, and you hear his heart and soul in this documentary, who cared so deeply about Haiti. Yes, the late, great actor and activist. It was presented by Jonathan Demme and Harry Belafonte. It aired on PBS. Juan Gonzalez wrote the script. And Noam Chomsky, among others, is interviewed in this film. We ask you to call right now and let us know that you're there. Haiti Killing the Dream. That documentary, yours for a contribution of $100. Resistance by K.K. Kane, by Catherine Kane, is yours for $100. And you will understand Haiti inside and out. We ask you to call and let us know that you're there. $200 or $150 for the 3-DVD Democracy Now! Set, Journey to the Epicenter of the Quake. All together for $250, we ask you to call. We ask you to stand up for independent media. We cannot do it without you, only with you. Make that call right now. Make the call that makes a difference. Keep those phone calls coming in. 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. And make it possible for WBAI to happen. Whatever you do, we must keep this station alive to communicate what is happening in Haiti, what is happening in Iraq and happening in Afghanistan, what is happening in Brooklyn, Bronx, Staten Island, and Queens, what is happening in Long Island and Connecticut and New Jersey, what's happening in Nigeria and South Africa. We urge you to call. What's happening in Indonesia and East Timor, we ask you to call and let us know that you're there. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. Keep those phone calls coming in. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Fill the phone lines. I'd love to break bread with you. I'd love to have dinner and a show with you, the show Democracy Now! And the dinner. Make that pledge of $2,000 or pledge $250, just $20 and change a month, and you'll get the 5-DVD set on Haiti. Haiti Killing the Dream. Haiti Journey to the Epicenter. Resistance. Please call, or any part of that, but make the call now. 212-209-2950. And thank you so much.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And As I Please, Assignment Locally is not going to be played to, is not going to be heard today, so we can play another episode of Democracy Now! Here on the last weekend of the membership drive. You can continue to call 212-209-2950, even while the next episode of Democracy Now!, which was originally broadcast on Friday the 19th, is aired. And if you heard a little bit of that and you want to hear the rest, go to WBAI.org. Go to the archives page and you can listen to any show from the last 90 days or our shows the last 2 weeks worth. So stay tuned now for more Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and we are asking after this very interesting hour for you to call and let us know that Democracy Now! Matters in your life, that Pacifica Radio matters to you. And we thought there's no better time to bring in Howard Zinn, the late Howard Zinn. It's still hard to say that. We lost the great historian a few weeks ago to a heart attack, but at the age of 87, he lived such a rich life and gave so much to so many by reshaping the way history books are written with his remarkable book, People's History of the United States. His work made into a documentary that aired on History, on the History Channel, called The People Speak. And we have in our hands the first edition of the DVD, The People Speak, which we are offering to you. It is truly remarkable. This documentary, which is more than what was on History Channel, about 20 minutes long, that Los Angeles Times calls striking, exhilarating, the performances are thrilling. The People Speak is produced by Matt Damon and Josh Brolin, Chris Moore, Anthony Arnov, and Howard Zinn. And it features the voices of Benjamin Bratt, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Chris Robinson, Christine Kirk, Danny Glover, Kerry Washington, John Legend. It is amazing. Morgan Freeman, Marissa Tomei, Martina Spada, Matt Damon, Sandra Oh, Sean Penn, Stacey Ann Chin, Viggo Mortensen. It's narrated by Howard Zinn, and we're going to go to a bit of it now. But if you'd like to call, because you know what's going to happen, the phone calls are going to go crazy. If you'd like to get this DVD, pledge $150. If you would like to get the companion CD, which is from the film The People Speak, that is incredible. The CD includes Jackson Browne and Bob Dylan and John Legend. It's the music, Eddie Vedder, Bruce Springsteen. The ghost of Tom Joad, Bruce Springsteen sings, Eddie Vedder sings Masters of War. Sail Away, Randy Newman sings, Drums of War is Jackson Browne, What's Going On is John Legend, See How We Are. Blues with a Feeling is Taj Mahal. Alison Moorer sings Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? That CD is yours. If you call right now for $100, the DVD of The People Speak, that is 20 minutes of never aired aired footage, as well as lots of bonuses, this is beyond the History Channel, is yours for $150. We ask you, please call and let us know you're there. And we're going to now turn to, well, Howard Zinn himself in The People Speak.
J.W. Logan, a former slave, helped organize the Underground Railroad in Syracuse, New York. When he received a letter from his former owner demanding that he return to slavery, Logan wrote this defiant letter in response.
Mrs. Sarah Logue, yours of the 20th of February is duly received, and I thank you for it. Now, you say you have offers to buy me, and that you shall sell me if I do not send you $1,000, and in the same breath and almost in the same sentence, you say, you know, we raised you as our own children. Woman, did you raise your own children for the market? Did you raise them for the whipping post? And you say I am a thief because I took the old mare along with me. Have you got to learn that I had better right to the old mare, as you call her, than Maniseth Logue had to me? Is it a greater sin for me to steal his horse than it was for him to rob my mother's cradle and steal me? If you or any other speculator on my body and rights wish to know how I regard my rights, they need but come here and lay their hands on me to enslave me. I will not budge. Not one hair's breadth.
No more auction block for me. Many thousands gone.
Frederick Douglass, a former slave, taught himself to read and write, and he became a leader of the anti-slavery movement. Asked to address the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society on the occasion of the 4th of July, Douglass said the following.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer. A day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour.